About 10 years ago, an otherwise perfectly sane woman named Zelda asked herself a particular question on one particular night. She asked, "Am I going crazy?" That night, she was at the theater with her husband. It was a musical, and they were waiting for it to start.
Zelda is a youthful 70.
That's Dr. Oliver Sacks, who wrote about Zelda in his book called Hallucinations.
I'm a neurologist of sorts.
Probably the most famous neurologist in the world, and Zelda is one of his patients. And when Oliver Sacks met her about 10 years ago, she told him about this particularly strange night at the theater. The show hadn't started, the curtain was still down, and then suddenly, an explosion of color burst from the curtain.
Roses.
Roses. Giant, vibrant roses.
Apparently grow out of the safety curtain and protrude beyond it.
So she was looking at a curtain and it began to turn into roses?
Yeah, there was a particular part of it. She talked about red, green leaves. It's not as if they were painted or two-dimensional. They seemed to thrust into the air towards her. And she had been astonished, staggered, stupefied, amazed. Any verb one can use is too mild.
So she closes her eyes.
And they're still there. She instantly realized it was a hallucination. Her general health was good and her mental health was good. She had never had a hallucination before, had never had any experience remotely similar.
And at that moment, in that theater, Zelda asked herself the question, am I crazy? Am I going crazy? It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on this episode, that place between madness and sanity. And on the show today, TED speakers who have all asked the same question Zelda asked. Am I going crazy? Now, in the case of Zelda, after observing her for a few months, Oliver Sacks figured it out.
She has what one would call Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Charles Bonnet syndrome. It's named after a Swiss botanist named Charles Bonnet, and Oliver Sacks described it in his TED Talk.
Charles Bonnet did not have them. His grandfather had these hallucinations. And in 1759, he described to his grandson various things he was seeing. So on one occasion, when his granddaughters were visiting him, he said, "And who are these handsome young men with you?" And they said, "Alas, grandpapa, there are no handsome young men." And then the handsome young men disappeared. It's typical of these hallucinations that they may come in a flash and disappear in a flash. On one occasion, he saw a man in a bathrobe smoking a pipe and realized it was himself. That was the only figure he recognized. On one occasion, when he was walking the streets of Paris, he saw, this was real, a scaffolding. But when he got back home, he saw a miniature of the scaffolding, 6 inches high, on his study table.
Charles Bonnet told his grandfather to keep a journal of all those hallucinations, and so 250 years later, Zelda did the same thing.
She said it had astonished her to find that she had many hallucinations every day.
What did she see?
Well, there was a very wide range. Sometimes she saw simple geometrical patterns, surfaces, walls would be covered with patterns like this. People's faces would occasionally change for her. I think on one occasion, the postman seemed to become gargoyle-like.
And then when she was driving, she'd also see things.
A boy appeared on the hood of the car, almost naked, pivoting, I think as if he were about to throw a discus or something like this. Her husband tried to shake the hallucination off, but the boy was there very tenaciously. But when they came to a parking lot, she said, he rose up and disappeared.
Charles Bonnet identified the condition, but he wasn't sure why it was happening. And it would take scientists another 150 years before they understood the reasons behind it.
When you gave your TED Talk, you had a line in there that struck me. You said,
As a physician, I have to try and define what's going on and to reassure people, especially
to reassure them that they're not going insane. In particular, the notion is that if you see things or hear things, you're going mad. But the psychotic hallucinations are quite different. Psychotic hallucinations, whether they're visual or vocal, they address you, they accuse you, they seduce you, they humiliate you, they jeer at you. There is none of this quality of being addressed with the Charles Bonnet hallucinations. You're seeing a film which had nothing to do with you. So what is going on? Fascinatingly, in the last few years, it's been possible to do functional brain imagery, to do fMRI on people as they are hallucinating. And in fact, to find that different parts of the visual brain are activated as they are hallucinating. When images are formed, a higher part of the visual cortex is involved in the temporal lobe. And in particular, one area of the temporal lobe is called the fusiform gyrus. And it's known that if people have damage in the fusiform gyrus, they may lose the ability to recognize faces. But if there's an abnormal activity in the fusiform gyrus, they may hallucinate faces. And around 1970, it was found that there were not only parts of the brain, but particular cells, face cells, were discovered around 1970. And now we know that there are hundreds of other sorts of cells, which can be very, very specific. So you may not only have car cells, you may have Aston Martin cells. I saw an Aston Martin this morning, I had to bring it in. And now it's in there somewhere. So there is another part of the brain which is especially activated when one sees cartoons. It's activated when one recognizes cartoons, when one draws cartoons, or when one hallucinates them. It's very interesting that that should be specific. There are other parts of the brain which are specifically involved with the recognition and hallucination of buildings and landscapes. Now, at this level, in what's called the infratemporal cortex, there are only visual images of or figments or fragments. It's only at higher levels that the other senses join in and there are connections with memory and emotion. And in the Charles Bonnet syndrome, you don't go to those higher levels. You're in these levels of inferior visual cortex where you have thousands and tens of thousands and millions of images or figments or fragmentary figments, all neurally encoded in particular cells or small clusters of cells. So suddenly you see a face, suddenly you see a car, suddenly this and suddenly that. The mind does its best to organize and to give some sort of coherence to this, but not terribly successfully. Charles Bonnet said 250 years ago, he wondered how, thinking of these hallucinations, how, as he put it, the theater of the mind could be generated by the machinery of the brain. Now, 250 years later, I think we're beginning to glimpse how this is done. Thanks very much.
At a certain point, we all ask ourselves, am I going crazy? Am I going mad?
Yes.
Happens to everybody.
I know very vividly when it happened with me. It was in the 1960s, and I suddenly started hallucinating. I ran for a bus, and on the bus, the people opposite me seemed to have huge egg-shaped heads, rather like Humpty Dumpty heads, with faceted insect-like eyes, which seemed to move suddenly. I was aware that this was a hallucination, and a severe one, and one I hadn't ordered, and one which bewildered me. I was very, very frightened. I think perhaps more frightened by a loss of control. I was fighting for control, and one form of doing that was to write, and as it were, to try and somehow become a reporter of my condition rather than totally immersed in it. I wanted to keep a level of critical consciousness from being drowned.
I was listening to a TED Talk by Ellen Sachs, who's schizophrenic. And by the way, she'll be on the show as well. And in her talk, she quotes the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who had met Freud. And Freud offered him psychoanalysis, and then Rilke says, no thanks. And do you know the quote?
Yeah, I do know the quote.
Don't take my devils away because my angels may flee too.
Yes. Freud was approached by a number of highly creative people with some mad-sounding symptoms. And basically he said, I think you can live with these and you may need to. I don't know how metaphoric or real Rilke's angels or devils were. But one may need some of one's devils and angels.
There are truly insane people. I mean, are we in some ways all of us in a kind of a gray area between that extreme and the other extreme of having no delusions or illusions or madness?
Freud brought this out, for example, when he spoke about common unhappiness. He agreed that there was a horrible and dangerous thing, which was depression or melancholia, which might lead to suicide and might ruin a life. But he felt that unhappiness as such was a feature of life and that one had to endure as well as enjoy. And people who don't may seem to be too shallow on the surface of life. People need depth, and depth means the possibility of unhappiness and frustration and sometimes torment, though hopefully not madness.
Neurologist Oliver Sacks. His latest book is called Hallucinations. So what if you're not in that gray area? What if feeling crazy isn't something fleeting, but the biggest part of who you are? Just ask Ellen Sacks. She was diagnosed with the equivalent of a life sentence at age 22.
As a young woman, I was in a psychiatric hospital on three different occasions for lengthy periods. At best, I was expected to live in a board and care and work at menial jobs.
Stay with us. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Hello, Ellen.
Is that Guy?
Yep, it's Guy here with the TED Radio Hour. How are you?
Hey, great to meet you, Guy. Well, thanks. How about you?
I'm okay.
How is it there? Really cold or not?
You know
bad?
What? It's freezing today. Today is the first freezing
so
day.
So this is Ellen Sacks. She's a law professor at USC. And a few years ago, she decided to do something, well, kind of crazy. She wrote a book about herself, and almost no one who knew her knew any of the things she went on to reveal in that book, because she's successful and distinguished and accomplished, and she also has schizophrenia. Here's how she described it in her TED Talk.
As a young woman, I was in a psychiatric hospital on three different occasions for lengthy periods. My doctors diagnosed me with chronic schizophrenia and gave me a prognosis of, quote, grave. That is, at best, I was expected to live in a board and care and work at menial jobs. Fortunately, I did not actually enact that grave prognosis. Instead, I'm a chaired professor of law, psychology, and psychiatry at the USC Gould School of Law. I have many close friends, and I have a beloved husband, Will, who's here with us today. Thank you. He's definitely the star of my show. I'd like to share with you how that happened and also describe my experience of being psychotic.
I like to say, actually, that an episode of schizophrenia is like a waking nightmare where you have all the bizarre images, frightening things happening. That's what it feels like, the terror, the confusion, impossible, bizarre happenings that don't happen in real life, but seem to be happening right now. Only with a nightmare, you sit up in bed and open your eyes. And it goes away. And you can't just open your eyes and make a psychotic episode go away.
Can you describe one of your psychotic episodes?
Yeah, you know, it started off looking like...
So, a bit of background here. Ellen had just graduated from Yale Law School. This was the early 1980s. And her therapist, who basically helped her get through her psychotic episodes, Ellen calls him Dr. White in her talk, he decided to shut down his practice.
I expected to leave New Haven in about 2.5 years, and he suddenly announced that he was closing his practice in 3 months. I had made it through Yale Law School and had my first law job as a result of working with him, and I was very attached and very dependent, and I just fell apart. And my closest friend, Steve, flew out to be with me in this difficult time.
So I got a call, and I decided that I would go back to New Haven immediately.
That's Steve, Steve Pankey.
And at that time, Ellen was living in an apartment close to the Yale campus. And I remember just getting out of my car and walking in the building and wondering what I would see when Ellen opened the door, and I had been on the back wards of, at that point, a number of psychiatric hospitals, and nothing had prepared me for how badly Ellen was doing at that time.
What did she look like?
Ellen looked exhausted, gaunt.
I stopped leaving my apartment.
The room was pitch black.
Shades were all drawn.
She could barely speak.
Wasn't bathing.
It smelled.
Had a lot of thoughts, delusions, and hallucinations. That I killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts, or a nuclear explosion was being set off in my brain.
So Ellen opened the door. She said, "Hi," and she turned around and began a very slow walk back to her couch, which was maybe 10 feet away, and I just followed her into the room and sat on the couch with her in silence for a very long time.
Time, time, time.
Ellen kept repeating those words.
I started saying things about time. Word, clock, voices. Time has come. Time is, time has come. Tell the clocks to stop. Time has come. Time is, tell the clocks to stop.
And then, Steve?
I said something like,
"White is leaving.
Dr. White is leaving."
At that point, he said.
And then there was another very long silence.
Silence. For hours. They just sat there in silence. And then they took a walk, a little walk around New Haven, just some fresh air. And eventually the psychotic episode, it was over.
And things got better.
And a few days later, Ellen's therapist, Dr. White, he changed his mind. He would stay. But the psychotic episodes also stayed, and Ellen would go on to spend days, sometimes hundreds of days, in mental hospitals, mostly against her will. Now, it took many, many years before she was able to get it under control, with almost daily therapy and heavy medication. But what makes Ellen's story so amazing is who she became, despite what she lives with.
I mean, Steve, you knew, I know, who Ellen was. I mean, she'd been a Marshall Scholar and a gifted law student, and yet she had this debilitating illness. Did you think that she would make it? Did you think that, you know, 30-plus years on, we would be sitting here talking to one of the most distinguished law professors at USC?
Oh, thank you. That's actually an interesting question. What's the answer, Steve?
I never had a moment's doubt, Ellen, that you were going to make it.
Really?
Never.
How come?
Well, you have a life force about you that I just watched. And you would get feedback from professors that you were brilliant. So it was always very clear to me that you had the intelligence to do anything that you wanted to do. And I knew that you had the will as well. And I think the combination of the two has made a wonderful life for you.
Yeah.
Ellen, in your TED Talk, you describe the medication that you're on and also how you resisted taking them for a long time.
Yeah, you know, people resist for various reasons. One being they don't like the side effect. They feel like they're not themselves. For me, and I think for a lot of people, the problem was the, quote, what we call in the business, the narcissistic injury of having a mental illness. I didn't want to believe that was true. The way I could prove that it wasn't true was getting off medication and doing well. I used to say, I don't want to use a crutch. I now say if my foot were broken, I'd use a crutch. Aren't my neurotransmitters entitled to as gentle treatment as a broken foot? So I've kind of reframed, you know, what medication is and does for me. I think it makes me, it restores me back to my normal, true, authentic self instead of changing me into something I'm not.
Do you still have psychotic thoughts?
Occasionally, yeah. Will, my husband, likes to say psychosis is not like an on-off switch but like a dimmer. So at the far end, I'll have a transient thought. Down toward the middle, you know, say we'll have house guests, which I love, but is also hard for me. And I may have 2 or 3 days where I'm in and out of psychotic thinking. And then at the far end, you know, I'm crouching in a corner shaking for weeks, which hasn't happened in more than a decade. So I do have symptoms, but they're farther apart, they're less intense, and they're less long-lasting than they used to be, which is to say, for the most part, I'm pretty clear, and I love it. And I recognize that other people are like this and that I was really just confused about reality.
It's amazing because we celebrate and venerate athletes and other public figures who overcome cancer
right.
and other diseases. Right. But right. we don't really talk about people who overcome mental illness.
Yeah.
Well, I think much of what surrounds mental illness is keeping it a secret from people.
Yeah.
And it is a terrible burden on top of a terrible burden.
Keeping a secret kind of puts a wedge between you and new people. And I have to say, though, that the response I've gotten has been overwhelmingly positive and supportive and kind.
You know, Ellen, that's wonderful, but also remember that response came after people knew what you had accomplished.
That's a good point.
But you know, it's the adage, the truth shall set you free, right? I mean, you have nothing to hide.
Yeah.
It must feel pretty good.
It feels great. I will say I have something still to hide. Everybody has something to hide.
At times I spent up to 20 hours in mechanical restraints. Arms tied, arms and legs tied down, arms and legs tied down with a net tightly across my chest. I never struck anyone, I never harmed anyone, I never made any direct threats. If you've never been restrained yourself, you may have a benign image of the experience. There's nothing benign about it. While I was preparing to write my student note for the Yale Law Journal on mechanical restraints, I consulted an eminent law professor who was also a psychiatrist and said surely he would agree that restraints must be degrading, painful, and frightening. He looked at me in a knowing way and said, Ellen, you don't really understand. These people are psychotic. They're different from me and you. They wouldn't experience restraints as we would. I didn't have the courage to tell him in that moment that no, we're not that different from him. We don't like to be strapped down to a bed and left to suffer for hours any more than he would. In fact, until very recently, and I'm sure some people still hold it, is the view that restraints help psychiatric patients feel safe. I've never met a psychiatric patient who agreed with that view. Today, I like to say I'm very pro-psychiatry, but very anti-force. I don't think force is effective as treatment, and I think using force is a terrible thing to do to another person with a terrible illness. Everything about this illness says I shouldn't be here, but I am, and I am, I think, for 3 reasons. First, I've had excellent treatment. 4 to 5 day a week psychoanalytic psychotherapy for decades and continuing, and excellent psychopharmacology. Second, I work at an enormously supportive workplace at USC Law School. This is a place that not only accommodates my needs, but actually embraces them. It's also a very intellectually stimulating place. And occupying my mind with complex problems has been my best and most powerful and most reliable defense against my mental illness. Third, I have many close family members and friends who know me and know my illness. These relationships have given my life a meaning and a depth, and they also help me navigate my life in the face of symptoms. Even with all that, excellent treatment, wonderful family and friends, supportive work environment, I did not make my illness public until relatively late in life. And that's because the stigma against mental illness is so powerful that I didn't feel safe with people knowing. If you hear nothing else today, please hear this. There are not schizophrenics. There are people with schizophrenia. And these people may be your spouse, they may be your child, they may be your neighbor, they may be your friend, they may be your coworker. Recently, a friend posed a question. If there were a pill I could take that would instantly cure me, would I take it? The poet Rainer Maria Rilke was offered psychoanalysis. He declined, saying, "Don't take my devils away because my angels may flee too." My psychosis, on the other hand, is a waking nightmare in which my devils are so terrifying that all my angels have already fled. So would I take the pill? In an instant. That said, I don't wish to be seen as regretting the life I could have had if I'd not been mentally ill, nor am I asking anyone for their pity. What I rather wish to say is that the humanity we all share is more important than the mental illness we may not. What those of us who suffer with mental illness want is what everybody wants. In the words of Sigmund Freud, to work and to love. Thank you.
Ellen Sachs. She's written a book about living with her illness. It's called The Center Cannot Hold, and her husband helped her proofread the chapters.
There's another thing I said when I was trying to get off medication my last time. I said, you know, "You're trying to put me in the hospital. Ha, ha, ha."
Ha, ha, ha. Hospitals are bad. They're mad. They're sad. One must stay away. I'm God, or I used to be. At that point in the text where I said, "I'm God," or "I used to be," my husband made a marginal note. He said, "Did you quit or were you fired?"
Now, if Ellen Sachs has been successful in spite of her mental illness, performer Joshua Walters has been successful because of his. He gave this TED Talk in New York.
My name is Joshua Walters. I'm a performer. But as far as being a performer, I'm also diagnosed bipolar. I reframe that as a positive because the crazier I get on stage, the more entertaining I become. When I was 16 in San Francisco, I had my breakthrough manic episode in which I thought I was Jesus Christ. Maybe you thought that was, scary, but actually, there's no amount of drugs you can take that can get you as high as if you think you're Jesus Christ. I was sent to a place, a psych ward, and in the psych ward, everyone is doing their own one-man show. There's no audience like this to justify their rehearsal time. They're just practicing. One day they'll get here. Now, when I got out, I was diagnosed and I was given medications by a psychiatrist. Okay, Josh, why don't we give you some, Zyprexa, okay? At least that's what it says on my pen. Some of you are in the field, I can see. I can feel your noise. The first half of high school was the struggle of the manic episode, and the second half was the over-medications of these drugs, where I was sleeping through high school. The second half was just one big nap, pretty much, in class. And when I got out, I had a choice. I could either deny my mental illness, or embrace my mental skillness. There's a movement going on right now to reframe mental illness as a positive, at least the hypomanic edge part of it. Now, if you don't know what hypomania is, it's like an engine that's out of control, maybe a Ferrari engine with no brakes. Many of the speakers here, many of you in the audience, have that creative edge. You know what I'm talking about. You're driven to do something that everyone has told you is impossible. And there's a book, John Gardner wrote this book called The Hypomanic Edge, in which Christopher Columbus and Ted Turner and Steve Jobs and all these business minds have this edge to compete. A different book was written not too long ago in the mid-90s called called Touch with Fire by K. Redfield Jameson, in which it was looked at in a creative sense, in which Mozart and Beethoven and Van Gogh all had this manic depression that they were suffering with. Some of them committed suicide, so it wasn't all the good side of the illness. Now, recently, there's been development in this field, and there was an article written in the New York Times, September 2010, in which investors were looking for entrepreneurs that had this kind of spectrum, if you know what I'm talking about. Not maybe full bipolar, but they were in the bipolar spectrum, where on one side, maybe you think you're Jesus, and on the other side, maybe they just make you a lot of money. Your call, your call. And everyone's somewhere in the middle. Everyone's somewhere in the middle. So maybe, you know, there's no such thing as crazy. And being diagnosed with a mental illness doesn't mean you're crazy. But maybe it just means you're more sensitive to what most people can't see or feel. Maybe. No one's really crazy, but everyone is just a little bit mad. How much depends on where you fall on the spectrum. How much depends on how lucky you are. Thank you.
Performer Joshua Walters at his New York TED Talk. In just a moment, writer John Ronson takes the psychopath test. Our show today, The Unquiet Mind. I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR with Guy Raz.
I think you can do that.
Yeah, you know, I was extrapolating with my arms.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should introduce you, or do you want to introduce yourself?
Okay, my name is John Ronson, and I am an author, nonfiction author.
Have you ever, like, lost it completely? Like, not, like, angry, but, like, lost control over what's happening in your head?
Oh, yes. Frequently, like, you know, once a week. Well, I mean, I suffer from anxiety, so quite often, you know, one intrusive thought will mash up into another intrusive thought, and it will kind of spiral. I mean, that's sort of part of the course with me.
Like, you can't concentrate on anything else. You're totally distracted by that one thing in your head.
Yeah, well, actually, the very worst occasion it ever happened. It was actually in Washington D.C., where you are now. I was in a hotel room. And I had this deal with my wife. This is when my baby was very young. I had a deal with my wife that she would always phone me like at 8:30 p.m. British time to tell me that everything was okay and Joel was asleep. One time she didn't phone And I was in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., and I called her and I couldn't get her. And I panicked and I became convinced that, you know, they were dead. And it was just so, you know, it was so irrational. And I started phoning the police and the fire brigade and my brother and the neighbours. Anyway, it turned out that she'd had a power cut and was at a friend's house and had forgot to call me. And then when I checked out of the hotel the next morning, the phone bill came and it was for $900 for one night.
Do you know something?
Uh-huh.
I've done the same thing.
Or exactly the same?
Yeah, almost exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I say in one of my books, The Psychopath Test, that I have panicked unnecessarily in all four corners of the globe. it's just...
So the book John just mentioned, The Psychopath Test, it's why we asked him to be part of today's program. We're talking about that place between madness and sanity. Anyway, John Ronson spent a year exploring what a psychopath is, and it became a kind of journey into his own mind. He's talked a lot about this over the past few years, including on stage at TED. We're going to hear your TED Talk in a sec. Is there anything we should know before we hear it?
Yes. This was part of a TED conference called Full Spectrum, and the idea was that people would try and come up with new ways of giving talks. So it wouldn't just be, you know, you talking in front of a PowerPoint. So Chris Anderson, when he asked me to do it, said he wanted to put me together with an audio man called Julian Treasure to do live audio on stage while I talked, like responding to the things I was saying. So you'll hear audio in the background, and that was actually happening live on stage right behind me.
Okay, let's hear it, and I might have some questions for you along the way.
This story starts. I was at a friend's house, and she had on her shelf a copy of the DSM manual, which is the Manual of Mental Disorders. It lists every known mental disorder. And it used to be back in the 50s a very slim pamphlet, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and now it's 886 pages long, and it lists currently 374 mental disorders. So I was leafing through it, wondering if I had any mental disorders, and it turns out I've got 12. I've got generalized anxiety disorder, which is a given. I've got nightmare disorder, which is categorized if you have recurrent dreams of being pursued or declared a failure. And all my dreams involve people chasing me down the street going, "You're a failure." I've got parent-child relational problems, which I blame my parents for. I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. I'm kidding. And I've got malingering. And I think it's actually quite rare to have both malingering and generalized anxiety disorder, because malingering tends to make me feel very anxious. Anyway, I was looking through this book, wondering if I was much crazier than I thought I was, or maybe it's not a good idea to diagnose yourself with a mental disorder if you're not a trained professional. Or maybe the psychiatry profession has a kind of strange desire to label what's essentially normal human behavior as a mental disorder. I didn't know which of these things was true, but I thought it was kind of interesting, and I thought maybe I should meet a critic of psychiatry to get their view, which is how I ended up having lunch with the Scientologists. It was a man called Brian, who runs a crack team of Scientologists who are determined to destroy psychiatry wherever it lies. They're called the CCHR. And I said to him, can you prove to me that psychiatry is a pseudoscience that can't be trusted? And he said, yes, we can prove it to you. And I said, how? And he said, we can introduce you to Tony. And I said, who's Tony? And he said, Tony's in Broadmoor. Now, Broadmoor is Broadmoor Hospital. It used to be known as the Broadmoor Asylum for the Criminally Insane. It's where they send the serial killers and the people who can't help themselves. And I said to Brian, well, what did Tony do? And he said, hardly anything. He beat someone up or something, and he decided to fake madness to get out of a prison sentence, but he faked it too well, and now he's stuck in Broadmoor, and nobody will believe he's sane. Do you want us to try and get you into Broadmoor to meet Tony? So I said, yes, please. So I got the train to Broadmoor. I began to yawn uncontrollably around Kempton Park, which apparently is what dogs also do when anxious. They yawn uncontrollably. And we got to Broadmoor, and I got taken through gate after gate after gate after gate into the wellness centre, which is where you get to meet the patients. It looks like a giant Hampton Inn. It's all peach and pine and calming colours, and the only bold colours are the reds of the panic buttons. And the patients started drifting in, and they were quite overweight and wearing sweatpants and quite docile looking, and Brian, the Scientologist, whispered to me, "They're medicated," which to the Scientologist is like the worst evil in the world, but I'm thinking it's probably a good idea. And then Brian said, "Here's Tony." And a man was walking in, and he wasn't overweight. He was in very good physical shape, and he wasn't wearing sweatpants. He was wearing a pinstripe suit, and he had his arm outstretched like someone out of The Apprentice. He looked like a man who wanted to wear an outfit that would convince me that he was very sane. And he sat down, and I said, "So is it true that you faked your way in here?" And he said, yep, absolutely. I beat someone up when I was 17, and I was in prison awaiting trial, and my cellmate said to me, "You know what you have to do? Fake madness. Tell him you're mad, you'll get sent to some cushy hospital, nurses will bring you pizzas, you'll have your own PlayStation." So I said, "Well, how did you do it?" He said, "Well, I asked to see the prison psychiatrist, and I'd just seen a film called Crash, in which people get sexual pleasure from crashing cars into walls. So I said to the psychiatrist, I get sexual pleasure from crashing cars into walls." And I said, "What else?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I told the psychiatrist that I wanted to watch women as they died because it would make me feel more normal." And I said, "Where'd you get that from?" He said, "Oh, from a biography of Ted Bundy that they had at the prison library." Anyway, he faked madness too well, he said, and they didn't send him to some cushy hospital. They sent him to Broadmoor. And the minute he got there, he said he took one look at the place, asked to see the psychiatrist, said, "There's been a terrible misunderstanding. I'm not mentally ill." I said, "How long have you been here for?" He said, "Well, if I'd just done my time in prison for the original crime, I'd have got 5 years. I've been in Broadmoor for 12 years.
Hold on one sec. How could he explain this in such a calm way? I mean, he was taking this in stride. Like, this is, well, you know, I guess I'm stuck here.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, he never was happy to be stuck there. You know, he saw me as a possible way out of Broadmoor. So he was actually very friendly and cheerful, but very keen to make me an ally in some way.
And he was just supposed to be there for 5 years. He was there for 12 years. I mean, that would drive him crazy, probably.
Oh, my God. And also, the way Broadmoor's set up, if you engage with the therapy, it means they can detain you indefinitely. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, the sort of weird catch-22 that they have at Broadmoor. So one way that Tony thought he could get out was to completely disengage in every single way with everybody there. So he refused to make small talk. He refused to you know, a sort of war of non-cooperation. He thought that would be his way out. But of course, you know, that made him seem crazy too. So there was no winning.
It turns out that you called his clinician who told you that actually, a telltale sign of being a psychopath is faking madness.
Exactly. So Broadmoor accepted after a while that, yes, he had faked madness to escape a prison sentence because his hallucinations had seemed quite clichéd and they vanished the minute he got to Broadmoor. But they assessed him and they determined that what he actually is
a psychopath. And in fact, faking madness is exactly the kind of cunning and manipulative act of a psychopath. It's on the checklist, cunning, manipulative. So faking your brain going wrong is evidence that your brain has gone wrong. And I spoke to other experts, and they said the pinstripe suit, classic psychopath, speaks to items 1 and 2 on the checklist, glibness, superficial charm, a grandiose sense of self-worth. And I said, I want to hang out with the other patients. Classic psychopath, it speaks to grandiosity and also lack of empathy. So all the things that had seemed most normal about Tony was evidence, according to his clinician, that he was mad in this new way. He was a psychopath. And his clinician said to me, if you want to know more about psychopaths, you can go on a psychopath spotting course run by Robert Hare, who invented the psychopath checklist. So I did. I went on a psychopath spotting course, and I am now a certified, and I have to say extremely adept, psychopath spotter. So here's the statistics.
One in 100 regular people is a psychopath. So there's 1,500 people in this room. 15 of you are psychopaths. Although that figure rises to 4% of CEOs and business leaders, so I think there's a very good chance there's about 30 or 40 psychopaths in this room. It could be carnage by the end of the night. When I got back to London, Tony phoned me. He said, "Why haven't you been returning my calls?" I said, "Well, they said that you're a psychopath." And he said, "I'm not a psychopath." He said, "You know what? One of the items on the checklist is lack of remorse. But another item on the checklist is cunning manipulative. So when you say you feel remorse for your crime, they say, typical of the psychopath, to cunningly say he feels remorse when he doesn't. It's like witchcraft. They turn everything upside down." He said, "I've got a tribunal coming up. Will you come to it?" So I said, "Okay." So I went to his tribunal. And after 14 years in Broadmoor, they let him go. They decided that he shouldn't be held indefinitely because he scores high on a checklist that might mean that he would has a greater than average chance of recidivism. So they let him go. And outside in the corridor, he said to me, "You know what, John? Everyone's a bit psychopathic." He said, "You are, I am." Well, obviously I am. I said, "What are you going to do now?" He said, "I'm going to go to Belgium because there's a woman there that I fancy, but she's married, so I'm going to have to get a split up from her husband." Anyway, that was 2 years ago, and that's where my book ended. And for the last 20 months, everything was fine. Nothing bad happened. He was living with a girl outside London. He was, according to Brian the Scientologist, making up for lost time. Which I know sounds ominous, but isn't necessarily ominous. Unfortunately, after 20 months, he did go back to jail for a month. He got into a fracas in a bar, he called it, ended up going to jail for a month, which I know is bad, but at least a month implies that it's whatever the fracas was, wasn't too bad. And then he phoned me. And you know what? I think it's right that Tony is out. Because you shouldn't define people by their maddest edges. And what Tony is he's a semi-psychopath. He's a grey area in a world that doesn't like grey areas. But the grey areas are where you find the complexity, and it's where you find the humanity, and it's where you find the truth. And Tony said to me, "John, can I buy you a drink in a bar? I just want to thank you for everything you've done for me." And I didn't go. What would you have done? Thank you.
Do you regret it, not going?
No, I don't, because for all the ambiguities of the story, and I, you know, remain pleased that Tony managed to get out of Broadmoor, he is a psychopath, and I've got a family. You've got to be careful. I mean, that's just the terrible truth of it. And again, for all the ambiguities of the story and for all the criticisms you can have of the culture of labelling, the culture of checklists, the, you know, ever-burgeoning nature of the DSM, conditions exist. Psychopathy exists, whatever you want to call it, it exists. And I think it's really important, actually, that, you know, I've always wanted this, my book and my TED Talk to stay very firmly in the middle ground, to see the truth and the problems on both sides of the argument.
Because it seems like that, like writing this book was almost like a journey of self-discovery. You know, I mean, I don't mean that like, you know, like in an Oprah way, but in like a, like you start to see psychopathic things in yourself.
Absolutely. I saw that to get on in journalism, I need to adopt certain psychopathic character traits. I need to be manipulative in my introductory emails. I need to not care about how people come over. And so it certainly became a book about me trying to work out my own sense of personal morality. It's also very much a book about how I became drunk with my psychopath spotting abilities and misused the psychopath checklist, and how confirmation bias, which is the way that people will only see things that confirm their pre-existing beliefs, is a huge problem. And I think the book is a kind of cautionary tale about don't succumb to confirmation bias.
It's almost like there's two ends of the spectrum. And as you, and you said this, I mean, that most of us are in that gray area between madness and sanity.
Yes. Yes. Very real conditions. I mean, obviously, everybody knows, you know, these conditions really exist. A lot of people really do have something. But there seems to be an increasing move towards conformity. And so the boundary of what it's of what is normal is getting narrower and narrower and narrower, to the extent that more than 50% of Americans soon will be diagnosable with a mental disorder. So being not normal is the new normal.
Where are you on the spectrum? Are you closer to madness or sanity?
A little crazy.
Me too. Should we get a drink? Writer John Ronson, his book is called The Psychopath Test. Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, Brent Bachman, and Neva Grant, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.